So how'd you like the deep dish?
Loved it, because Chicago. And we're in a back room.
We're in a back room at Exchequer Pizza because we are celebrating our recording live at DePaul University. And it was a great recording.
It was a fantastic recording. Great crowd. We talked about youth activism and the first topic that we did with youth activism and gun violence.
So
it was so good.
Without any further ado, let's just get to our live audience at DePaul University. Man, they were clapping up a storm. Let's take a listen. Welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela. And we are here
live from Chicago at DePaul University.
Yeah, DePaul!
Oh my God!
There we go.
I love Chicago, man.
You're from Chicago, so...
Well, I'm from Mexico. You know, I'm a proud Mexican, but I was raised on the south side of Chicago.
Yo.
I love Chicago!
Yo.
All right, so today, we're in front of, I would say a pretty young-looking audience, because we're talking about, actually, the power that you have as young people. And oftentimes, I know that it feels, I certainly felt as a young Mexican immigrant growing up on the south side of Chicago, I often felt invisible and powerless. But I think what we know and what we're reflecting back to you is you have incredible amounts of power. And we're recording in Chicago in front of a live audience on the topic of the power of young people. And we're going to talk about how activism can fight violence in the streets of our cities, in the hallways of our schools, and in our communities. I don't often fangirl, but I'm having a fangirl moment. Please give a huge round of applause to Edna Chavez. She is a national activist and member of the Community Coalition based in Los Angeles, California. A little over a year ago, she exploded on the national stage, which is when I fell in love with her, when she spoke at the March for Our Lives. Edna Chavez, welcome to In the Thick. So happy. And representing Chi-Town, let's say hello to Cosette Hampton. She is also on the South Side right now. She's a leader with the Chicago chapter of the Black Youth Project 100. She's a student at the University of Chicago. The Black Youth Project is known as BYP 100. Welcome, Cosette!
Hi. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Everything's cool.
So we're going to talk about something that we know that Black and brown youth suffer way too much. And it's violence. And it's violence in many different forms. You know, there are entire generations of teenagers in this city and our country who have lost family members and friends to this kind of violence. And I'm thinking about, Edna, the first time I saw you when you were on stage at March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C. You took the mic and you gave a speech a little over a year ago. You were just 17 years old. And you told the world about the trauma of losing your brother, Ricardo, to gun violence. And actually, it was kind of an unforgettable moment because you said to the entire audience, say his name. And this sea of people were saying, Ricardo, Ricardo.
Right. And the power of that speech, Edna, we took the video, put it up on Latino Rebels, and within like 3 days, it got like 3 million views. For me, it was like you literally burst through the national stage over a year ago.
So, Edna, talk to us a little bit about that journey. Like, you know, experiencing that kind of violence in your own family. And then understanding that, you know, you could have remained sad and paralyzed. But you took it in a different direction. So did that happen naturally? What kind of a process was it for you? And how much did you basically have to say, you know, whatever's going on in my head, I'm just going to jump in and do this because of your own fear?
So it was a very, very hard, very emotional process because I never said Ricardo after his death. And that was over 12 years ago. I never even spoke about him just because when he passed away, everything kind of just died off with him. But, like, you know, being a young girl and, like, witnessing his own death, it was pretty hard on me because it was just like, why should we forget somebody who was, like, a role model to me? Even though he was, like, a fucking machista and all this other stuff and would raise me like a little boy.
Pero, it's complicated.
But at the same time, you know, he's the one that made me the person I am today. When I was composing the speech, it was very hard just because I didn't really want to mention Ricardo because it was still so heavy on my heart and still is, but not so much where it's just like I'll break down immediately just thinking about him. Like now it's just more so I'm at peace with myself. My family is at peace because now we know that everybody that heard that speech knows his story, knows his name, and chanted out his name. So that's my angelito right there.
Angelito, Ricardo, you're present.
Yeah, and so it was very hard, and it was very emotional. And so it was a moment where I said, okay, and I finally said his name, and it was a relief to me, like a weight.
Felt a little liberated, like lifted. Like,
yeah, because we have this, is it okay to cuss?
Yeah, it's okay to cuss.
That's what I said.
Because we have this fucked up president, like, oh my goodness. I don't even, I just refer to him as a number. Like, he wants to put numbers on us as people of color. No, he could be the fucking number, not us. And so then, so with him, like, being so public about his racism, like, we always knew racism existed, but the way he put it out there, it was just kind of like, that's that nerve. But then that also put fear in me because it was just like, because I am, you know, this young Latina who, like, you know, went with her hoop earrings, with her wine-colored lipstick, like, proud. But at the same time, like, because people are so racist, that could have just been, like, a target on me. And my life could have ended right there and then as soon as I said, hola, buenas tardes. And so I remember laying with my mom, and I was just crying to her. And she was just like, don't cry. Like, you got this. Like, you have to do this. Like, if you don't do it, who else? And I remember just grabbing her hand, and she was already falling asleep. And I just told her, like, mamita, like, if anything ever... Of course, this was in Spanish. Pero I told her, mamita, like, if anything ever happens to me, like, I need you to stay strong for yourself. I need you to stay strong for my sisters. I need you to just stay strong. Like, no matter what, just know I did what I had to do. And I always loved you, and you have been the best role model ever. Basically just telling her, like, if I don't see you tomorrow again, like, if I'm not able to lay down with you again, just know that I love you.
You, first of all, you're about to cry right now, which is okay, but I'm trying to understand that you thought that by going on that stage and speaking that you might be subject to violence?
Yeah.
Is that... So you were literally saying adios, mama?
Yeah, I mean, growing up in South Central, I have been shot at before. Like, you know, getting my own nephew out of the car, I had to throw him inside the house because there were bullets going through. And I remember the next morning we realized that we had bullet holes on our own wall. And so, you know, it's just kind of like you have to say goodbye and your I love you. So I did that with my mom. You know, I had to tell her because I was just so scared. And so the next morning came in. I had the worst anxiety ever. And I suffered from a really bad anxiety disorder as well. And I'm very open about that just because mental health is something that needs to be spoken about. And it's very, very important.
That gets a clap.
Yeah. So you made it on stage and you changed history is all I want to say.
You made it on stage.
You took all of that fear, anxiety, doubt, worry about your own life, which is honestly me pega muy duro that you thought that was could happen to you in the United States of America. You transformed all of that
rage and pain into power. So, Edna, thank you for sharing your story. And
thank you for showing up that morning.
Yeah.
Thank you for showing up.
And for what you did. But I want to bring Cosette into this because I want to hear your story as well, Cosette. But also in the context of we're talking about violence, and these are just some statistics that the organization Every Town for Gun Safety, the support fund, says that nearly 3,000 children and teens are shot and killed, and about 15,000 are shot and injured every year. That's 51 young people every day. So we're talking about transforming pain into power, but what about your story, Cosette? Like, how do you navigate through those numbers and those stories? Because every number has a story. Yeah. What's driving you?
It starts off with just the fact that recognizing that these numbers, these statistics are people, and these are people's everyday experiences. Mm. These are people's family members and friends. My involvement, basically, in this movement that I would say is similar to the Black freedom movement of our past, to the Black power movement of our past, to the civil rights movement of our past, started for me when I was about 12 years old. And one of my classmates, I went to a Christian school on the far south side of Chicago. I'm from the far south side of Chicago, from the Roseland neighborhood.
Yep. South side.
South side. And one of my classmates, Lair Holt, was killed on a Chicago Transit Authority bus, CTA bus, trying to protect another young lady who was on the bus. Someone had entered the bus. A lot of times gangs will do indiscriminate shooting in order to get into the gang. And Blair Holt was shot, and I was about 12 years old. And my school held this massive march around the community. And I remembered that while we were walking, even as a mere sixth or seventh grader, police were constantly pushing us from block to block, trying to stop our path. And I began to think beyond the person that is pulling the trigger and into the policy that creates the conditions for that situation. Even as a 12-year-old, when Blair Holt was killed, I was thinking, we can talk about this in the context of the person that got on the bus to do shooting, but we're all from the same community. Blair Holt is from the same community that that other boy was in. Blair Right. Holt jumped in front of this girl, and this other person was on the bus trying to harm people. So does it really mean that there is a inherent nature of violence that the media is trying to place on young Black people in the city of Chicago and across the United States? Is Chicago now really Chirac? No, it's not. And also, what does it mean that we have all of this security, all of this overt policing, surveillance, cameras on CTA buses, German Shepherds sniffing people out on CTA Wow. buses, but none of these things could save his life? What actually would have made an impact before the young man got to the bus? Could it have been community programs? Could it have been a job? Could it have been a sense of family and community that he was seeking out in the gang culture? Because a lot of times we don't talk about the history of gang culture and how it's yeah. really created as a system of protection.
If there's no community, let's create one yeah. because it's going to make you feel like you're, yeah. you belong.
Yeah. And of course, and I've had family members who've been involved in gangs. I think a lot of us in Chicago have, just because it stretches such a long history. So what does it mean to look at that person and also see my family?
Mm. Many of my students here on this campus have family members at one time were involved with a gang. And it's like, they're students here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we can't take all of that and just put them all in jail. It's like there's something that's much more complex.
And I need to pause for a second and just acknowledge these two voices that are on stage in this group.
Preach, preach.
Because
preach.
I think what you heard from these two amazing young voices who are speaking with truth, you know, voices like yourselves, we don't hear you guys. Like when people talk about gun violence, no one's talking to you. We have this sort of simplified debate that, to be honest with you, looking at the statistics, there's a racial component to this action. I mean, Edna, you mentioned just how, you know, targeting or criminalizing brown people in this administration has led to your fear of like, oh, I'm going out in public and I'm gonna lose my life, which I'm like in America, right? And you, Cosette, at 12 years old, connecting the dots. And you guys both come from places that have been notoriously trope-ish, right? Chicago and South Central Los Angeles, where it's like those are community, like violent communities, and we see them on television, and all we're seeing is like
putting air quotes
exactly
like, violent.
This was really interesting from the Black Youth Project, the survey at the University of Chicago. It says that amongst young people, 76% of Black people support gun ownership control. With Latinx, that number is similar, and this is young people, about 70%. But among white youth, there's a drop. Only 57% support gun control. So let's talk about the racial component about this, because it's like, and you said it, Cosette, too, it's like, I'm in the community. It's not like we want violence.
Well, what it seems to be saying is that white young people feel that they need to be more protected by carrying guns than kids of color who are actually living in those communities who are saying, we don't want more guns.
Exactly.
Yeah, we don't want more violence. Why bring more violence into a community that we're trying to heal, right? Mm. And it ties back to so many, many, many things, whether it be the educational system, whether it be educational, environmental, social justice, it all ties into to this. And so in South Central, you know, in my high school, it literally looks like a jail. There's gate and gates and gates and gates and gates.
Like on the windows?
There's gates on the windows. We have to go through like three different gates even to get inside the campus. It's just a whole process for no reason. I'm just like, damn, I'm just trying to get to biology or something. Like what? Like what?
And actually, okay, we're laughing, but actually
no.
At those gates, there are police. Are there guards? Are they armed?
Yeah. There's police guards. So like I said, it's literally like a jail. And so, and then I know that they were trying to bring more police in, and it was just kind of like, nah, what's the point of you guys bringing more police officers in? Bring more teachers, because clearly we have big-ass classrooms for no reason. Or we don't even have enough teachers. We always have substitutes, and that affects our grades. So what are you doing with more police? What are they going to do? They're not going to teach me chemistry. They're not going to teach me English. They're not going to teach me algebra or whatever.
Wow, yeah.
What are they going to teach me how to do? Use a taser? And so with that being said, the more police that they bring in, the more criminalized we feel. And I remember having this conversation with one of my homies, because he's just very like, nah, like, it's not even that. Da, 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 da. And I was just like, look, this is what it is. The more police you bring in, the more criminalizations happen amongst black and brown youth. When black and brown youth get criminalized, it's a whole cycle where you feel you basically convince yourself that you're this person what officials say you are, which is a criminal, air quotes, criminal, a gang member, all this other like negativity. What? No, I'm just trying to get home. I'm just trying to go to school. I'm just trying to go buy a mangonada. Like, what are you doing? Like, I'm not doing anything. Just because I wear Cortezes, just because I wear Dickies, just because I wear hoop earrings, just because my homeboy got his Nike socks on, don't mean that we gangbang. It just means that that's a part of our culture. And if you can't appreciate it, then fuck off, because we appreciate our own selves.
Wow. Okay. Cosette, what do you think all this?
I can interject there, because there was a Department of Justice report that was supposed to come out. But, of course, Orange Man Trump chose to cancel it. And basically, in the Police Accountability Task Force report that came out in 2017, it showed that though black youth are 6 times more likely to be stopped and searched by a police officer, white youth are 3 times more likely than black youth to have drugs on them, marijuana on them. So when I think about the way that schools are policed, they're not necessarily even policed according to correct statistics. They're policed according to the color of somebody's skin. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's
what fascinates me. It's like there's obviously a racial component to the gun debate, through the gun control debate, mm-hmm. through the violence debate. Your city has become a trope, Cosette. I mean, like, anytime there's any violence anywhere in the world, like, even with undocumented, it's like, migrants dying at the border. It's like, well, what about Chicago? Right? Yeah. It's like, let's talk about Chicago. So tell me personally, like, how are you dealing with that? Because how do you fight the bullshit?
Yeah, no. First, I want to lift up Marissa Alexander, who is a black woman. Yeah, lift her up for a second.
Let's lift up. Yeah.
Lift her up. So Marissa Alexander is a black woman who was a victim of domestic violence, and she fired a single shot into the air in her home as a single warning shot, and she was threatened with years and years of prison time.
Wow.
So then also you said 76% of black people,
young black people,
want gun control. This is because guns and gun ownership has never really protected black and brown people the way that they've protected white folks.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
So when we use guns in defense of ourselves and to protect ourselves, like Marissa Alexander, we end up coming under more criminalization. We end up getting way more jail time. We get harder sentences by judges, no matter what the color of the judge is, actually. Mm. Because once you join the system, once you enter a system, black and brown folks that become police officers, black and brown folks that uplift punitive policies as judges, they implore that same violence, that same amount of jail time on communities. And so over time, we've had this constant discussion, well, maybe if there were more black and brown police officers in black and brown communities, there would be less gun violence in our communities. However, in the case of Detective Dante Servin, when he was in the community with Rekia Boyd, he saw a group of young black people walking, and he felt threatened by their presence in their community. And he shot Rekia Boyd in the head. So when we think about, you know, having more police that are community-centric in the community, or even more black and brown police officers or black and brown guards, these folks are not changing the system. They are being changed by the system. So the way that we want to counteract some of those violent things is by having more summer jobs for youth. If we can have 1,200 more police officers. Let's think if the average salary of each police officer is $50,000.
Just saying.
Multiply $50,000 times 1,200 and think about all the jobs that you could create for young people in this city. And that can keep people busy.
Yeah.
So what both of you are, though, is you're part of a legacy of a kind of youth activism that, in fact, is not new. So I'd love for you both to kind of talk about that. The fact that, you know, what you're doing now is different.
Yeah.
Because you're both here, right? And what do you think has kind of changed in the legacy of youth activism? Because I'm part of that, too. I mean, I was cutting my teeth on electoral and street politics on 18th Street. But what's changed in your sense of the kind of activism and youth activism that you're doing and seeing now?
Yeah, and I think also what you're saying is, like, very timely. It was just a few weeks ago that there were a lot of young black and brown youth that were downtown Chicago, and a lot of the media described them as descending upon downtown.
Oh, God.
And,
really,
you know,
the language?
A fleet of them. And
swarming into downtown.
Bees, they're animals or something. And I'm just like, these are, like, people. Yeah. These are people walking around their city. If folks are so uncomfortable with young black and brown people walking around downtown and enjoying themselves, then maybe they should leave. If we think about when there was the Cubs won, and I'm also a White Sox fan, but it's okay.
That's all right. Southside,
hey,
represent.
Uh-oh. we got some people.
I love that this turned into baseball.
Oh, my gosh.
Say more, Cosette.
No. No, but when the Cubs won whatever it was, they won.
They won something?
All right.
There were so many white people that were downtown in Wrigleyville flipping over cars, creating havoc, having tons of trash and garbage. And none of them were described as swarming or descending upon the city. And so I really think that this youth movement, to your point, is really in general. We, with Black Youth Project 100, also we're an organization of 18 to 35-year-olds across the United States mobilizing toward our vision of Black queer feminist freedom. So thank you.
Love it.
So on point number one, I think it's a statement that we have. It's called Unapologetically Black. And I think that black youth right now in particular are just being very unapologetic about their blackness. Like you said, like, we're going to be how we are. You know, we're going to wear our hair how we're going to wear our hair. We're going to say what we want to say and be present in the space. And then number two, I think there's a lot of queer youth that are also coming to the forefront of these conversations about both inter-community violence, police violence, and state-sanctioned violence. And so I think that when you have both of these historically marginalized groups, people of color, queer folks, people of color who are also queer, coming together to talk about these things, you have a new dimension of mobilization that really hasn't been present in the history of this patriarchal, homophobic, transphobic, white supremacist country.
Wow.
Preach. Wow.
Right. She basically said it all. Like, literally.
But what do you think about the legacy of, like Maria saying, you know, in South Central and LA, the legacy of youth and activism? You know, I think of the 60s and, the Chicano movement and the civil rights movement. How is it changing? How have you changed that?
I just feel like we're just more present. Like, we just recognize that we have this power. And we're just like, okay, we have this power. We have our voice. Now let's hit the streets and take them over.
Okay.
And so there it is.
It's literally that. Can you just say that one more time?
Oh, we have this power. We have this voice. So now let's hit the streets.
Hello.
And it's true, and that's how it's been. Like, we're just nonstop. It'll continue to go. It'll continue to rise until we have those resources, until we have those jobs, until we have that change, until we have affordable housing, and until all of our families are back together.
Whoa, yeah.
Thank you for both those answers. But we want to talk a little bit about, I guess there's an election next year, right? 2020. There's like two football teams of presidential candidates. I've lost track.
Long live democracy is all I'm
saying. Long live democracy, right? But we haven't really heard a lot of candidates talking about violence and gun reform. Given what's happened the last couple of years in the post-Parkland world and the March for Our Lives, that you would think it would be a little bit more out there. But, you know, there are some candidates, for example, Senator Kamala Harris of California said she'd enact gun control within her first 100 days through executive action. She would include near universal background checks to be run by people selling more than 5 guns a year. She revoked the licenses of gun manufacturers and dealers that break the law. She talked about a 1994 law that would ban assault weapons that expired in 2004. And then Julian Castro, the only Latino in the race that people seem to forget, he actually was very vocal about gun reform early. And he talked about universal background checks, limiting the capacity of magazines, and an assault weapons ban. But at the same time, it doesn't feel like they're talking enough, Edna. I mean, are they getting it? Are they just kind of giving it lip service? What are they missing?
Like, when you see what's happening in terms of the candidates and the electoral process in terms of the presidential, are you feeling like they're understanding
listening to,
and listening to the power
that you just brought? Yeah.
I feel like in a way they are, but they're just kind of listening just to give us a response that we want to hear. Mm. And that's real. And so though there are people that are genuine with like making these changes and stuff like that, let's make sure we, the people that are voting for them, hold them accountable as well. Let's hold ourselves accountable for holding them accountable.
And what does that look like when you say that? Because I bet some of the activists or people who may not be activists just say, well, that's a big word, but I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to make them accountable. So what does that look like?
If they're not doing what they were speaking, then you just ask them what's up. Like, you go to the streets again. You have this voice. You hit the streets. You protest. I love protesting. I started when I was 15. And I would be like, yeah, what's up? Like, we here. What you gonna do? And so I love protesting. And it's just a way where it's just like, with having so many, like a big group, such a big diverse group, it's just so beautiful to see. And then the way that we create this change by being so heavily present, it's just amazing. And it just goes to show that our presence and our voice goes a long way.
So, yeah.
Cosette.
What's your impression of the debate? Are they missing the boat still?
The candidates.
I think the candidates will, for a very long time at least, will probably always miss the target, which is why I really vibe with what Edna said, because for a very long time, the Black Youth Project 100, we really have never wanted to endorse candidates. Why? Because we always want to be able to hold candidates accountable, regardless of how much we like them and regardless of identity politics. You know, just because Kamala is Black, I still see her as a cop. And all of those solutions that she has are very copy. Like we just said, like,
copy. Yeah, oh my copy. God, I think that's the first time.
We're about to use that when we get the interview with her. We're definitely going to be like,
when we interview copy. Senator, like, are you too copy?
Yeah,
I love it. And we will give you credit for that.
Really, because of all the things we just said, when a lot of these gun control has to, first and foremost, to me, start with demilitarization of our military and defunding of our police and reinvesting in communities and reinvesting in restorative policies. Mm. And also, y'all, I know it's not as, you know, it's a little boring, but I'm a student of policy. I'm a soon-to-be master of public policy.
Hey. Give it up!
Give it up, yes.
From the University of Chicago.
Thank you. And a lot of the protests, what a lot of people don't understand is that the behind of the protest starts with policy intervention. Before we get out into the street, we're saying, oh, 40% of the city of Chicago's budget is going towards policing. Or whenever we have enforced gun control laws, black homes are targeted first in violent ways. Mm. Police are busing in on women with their children and pointing their guns at children. And we want to make sure that when a gun control policy is passed, that it's passed in a way that does not cause more home entry, that causes deportation. We want to make sure that it's not causing heightened levels of criminalization in our communities. And we want to make sure that any of the candidates that are running are listening to our policy platforms, and then we are taking it to the streets when they choose not to listen to us. So this is always a feedback loop that a lot of people don't notice until it gets to the point where we're in the restaurant with Rahm Emanuel yelling at him, forcing him to stop sending ICE to Pilsen and Little Village with OCAD and Mi Gente. Or until we are, you know, yelling at him, demanding that you support us in the Obama Community Benefits Agreement that's going to help stop gentrification in black and brown communities on the south side of Chicago. Also, we need folks who can vote, folks who are 18 and plus, to hold aldermen accountable, state elected officials accountable. And by accountability, that means voting them out when they don't do what the fuck we want. Like, we can't just keep on being, you know, and voting is not the only way, but we cannot be complacent, and we have to talk to each other and build these systems of power so that we can bring down basically the walls of Jericho that, like, have been constantly held up over the years.
Oh, man.
Well, wow. That's a wrap. Thank you so much to our live In the Thick audience. Woo! We specifically want to thank the young people and educators who've come out today, and my students, by the way. We have youth organizers. We have a podcast club and future journalists from schools like Hancock College Prep and Benito Juarez. And a huge round of applause for Edna Chavez, member of the Community Coalition, and Cosette Hampton of BYP 100. Thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this edition of In the Thick.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Nos vemos. Hasta la próxima. Ciao. Ciao.
Uno, dos, tres.
We want you to remember to go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. Also, remember that you can listen to In the Thick on Pandora and Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends. And there were several people in the Chicago audience who came up to me and say, I tell all my friends to listen. In the Thick is produced by Nicole Rothwell and our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow, Noor Saudi. Our audio engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso, and our intern is Noelis Siriaco. The music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kep and CCK Records. Thank you so much for listening to this live recording from Chicago. We'll see you on our next episode. Hasta la próxima.
Bye, Chicago.
Chicago. Where we're on Wabash.
And we're going to end this event with Asada Lewis. Bring it home.
Peace, y'all. My name is Asada. I am a poet, playwright, actor. I'm a part of BYP 100, Kumbalinx, Good Kids, Mad City. I'm 19 years old, and I've been organizing since I was about 11. And so you guys saw Cosette Hampton, who was a part of BYP 100 and is a close friend of mine, and Darius Parker, who's my mentor and who kind of helped me and shaped me as a poet and as an artist, as an organizer. And so, yeah, I just want to open the space with how we usually do it in Kumba Links. So if everybody can repeat after me, peace,
peace.
Love,
love,
respect,
respect
for myself, peace,
peace.
Love,
love,
respect,
respect
for everybody,
everybody.
Paz, amor,
amor,
respecto,
respect
para todos,
ashe,
ashe,
ashe.
All right, and this poem is dedicated to Bresha Meadows and any girl incarcerated, locked up in detention centers whose stories are so close and similar to hers. Say her name. Say her name. Say her name. My home, a garden, an ever-rotting evergreen, a pesticide-filled household made of father, mother, and me in this garden. Papa laid pesticides around the ring in mama's eye in the form of fists, all infected and garden gutting. He turns this home herbicide clogged and coffin closed. Bresha Meadows, me. A 15-year-old flower watches my mother's stem grow limb. And since mama can't kill the pesticide, I have no choice but to bloom my body for war. On Thursday, July 28th, I sit bedside perched with an anti-pesticide pistol positioned perfect on my plant. My mother is still a punching bag for my father's insomnia. Today, he finally sleeps. So I walk out of my room. The ground feels like it's cracking underneath my feet. My vision blurs by how quick I can see this going wrong. I tiptoe to the end of the hallway and walk through an open door. There my father lay, a relaxed reincarnation of the devil. I stand over him, entire being earthquaking. I ivy my fingers around the 45, Meadows into metal, grip the trigger tight enough and let God do the rest. His spirit never left, never rose. God would never let him splinter the heavens the way he did his family. And out of all the times this country chooses to enforce self-defense, they gave me a plea deal, forced me to confess to being the predator when I was clearly the stronger prey. Now, this meadow, this ever-growing greenery, sits in a correctional vase. I now belong to the GMO that denied me assistance in the first place. I was criminalized for surviving, for having no other choice. Even when I ran away and asked for help, they said I needed some form of confirmation, which shows to be black woman and abused is to need a man to confirm the trauma. In my cell, I become rose woman, thorny due to harsh conditions. Most likely to be plucked without permission, but just because I bend don't mean I break to male submission. So for those who didn't listen, here grows a girl in a garden where a male pesticide penetrated. So I reacted with the same venom he introduced me to. Ain't no more help wanted. Just let me go. Let me back into my home. Let me freeze so I can finish repairing the pots that my dad has shattered. Let me remember that my life is not confined to the death of this one man. Let me go home to a garden free of pesticides. Like, say her name, Bresha, say her name, Meadows, say. Her name, Bresha, say. Her name, Meadows. Thank you.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.